Thank you very much.
Amarillo, Texas, October 29, 1968.
Which they cannot control. They are limited by circumstances which deny them opportunity. They are limited by circumstances which tend to lock them into lives without any hope for improvement. And we've always had Americans in these kinds of circumstances. But because of the fact that the rest of us have been determined to build an open, free, expanding society, we have constantly reduced the numbers of those who are outside the mainstream. We've done this with immigrants from overseas, some 40 million of them at the turn of the century were absorbed into this country. We bestowed this country's blessings upon them, and I'm the descendant of one of them, and in the process we were enriched by what they brought here in terms of intelligence and skills and cultural heritage. It's been a two-way proposition. America, in growing great, has created opportunity for more and more people, and by absorbing more and more different kinds of people has enlarged its capacity to become greater still. You in these great open spaces of Texas in the West understand that great lesson of American history. And here in these great open spaces, it's easier to put that lesson to work in the year 1968. But it's more difficult to do it in the more crowded metropolitan areas of the eastern sections of our country, where too many Americans have lost hope for the future. Can we apply the lesson of America, the lesson of expanding opportunity, the lesson of unleashing individual creativity and energies? How do we do it in a crowded society where the individual feels less significant, less important, less able to shape his own life, less able to develop the policies which decide the direction in which his life will move? This is the great challenge of the year 1968. And I say to you, the answer to that problem, the answer to that challenge, is the answer which you Texans have put to work here in your great state of Texas. I know that some of your qualities are exaggerated into weaknesses and vanities. But really, underlying the expansiveness of Texas is this fundamental belief that the way to build a future for people is to expand our country. And that's what we've been trying to do in the last 8 years. And Mr. Nixon, each of them has been associated with a different administration. Mr. Nixon from 1952 to 1960, Mr. Humphrey from 1960 to 1968. And what is the story of those two administrations? From 52 to 60, we had three recessions, which cost us $175 billion in lost production. Lost production which lessened the opportunities of individual Americans. Lost production, which lessened our capacity as a society to provide the schools, the opportunities needed by our people. Lost production, which lessened our capacity to build new industry, new enterprise, to provide the jobs and the opportunities for those who did not have them. That was the lesson of the 50s. And when Mr. Nixon was campaigning in 1960, he described that eight-year period as the period of the greatest progress and the greatest opportunity in our national history. Now, any man who can look at that kind of a record and describe it that way is not the man we can entrust with the problems which face our country in the next 4 years. And what's been the lesson of the next 8 years? We've had 91 months of uninterrupted economic growth. Economic growth, which has increased our national production by $364 billion this year over what it was the last year that Nixon was vice president. Well, what has this meant? It has meant, first of all, a better life for most Americans. It has meant, secondly, more opportunities for those Americans who did not have them. But equally important, it has enabled us to double our annual investment in schools, to double our annual investment in health facilities, to double our annual investment in new plants and industries, thus creating the kinds of new opportunities we need to expand America's potential for all our people. This has been the record of the last 8 years. Unemployment grew from 1952 to 1960 from 2 million to 5 million. It increased to a rate of 7% a year. In the last 8 years, that unemployment has been reduced by 2 million and the unemployment rate has been cut in half. Now, this is important, this difference. First of all, it reflects the fundamental approach of these two candidates for president to the economic needs of our country. Secondly, it reflects the fundamental approach to the problem of providing the public services necessary to harness individual initiative and private enterprise to the expanding future which we need. Mr. Nixon approved the policies of the 50s. He denounced the policies proposed by Mr. Kennedy. He has criticized the record of the last 8 years. The only way then to ensure that we have a repetition in the next 4 years, not of the 50s, but of the 60s, is to support Vice President Humphrey for the presidency and to reject Richard F. Nixon. You know, in this campaign, I've seen many signs like this one, which I saw in Los Angeles yesterday. And the sign said simply this: it's time for Nixon now. Well, why now? He wasn't good enough in 1960 for the country. He wasn't good enough for the people of California in 1962. Well, why in 1968 should we regard him as good enough to deal with the tough problems which we face in this country? It's a new Nixon. Well, we all know here that when you've seen one Nixon, you've seen them all. And what we've seen of Nixon in his uncreative congressional years, in his uncreative vice presidential years, in his non-communicative candidate this year, what we've seen holds no promise whatsoever of a concern or a capacity to do those things or to implement those policies which we need if America is to continue to grow as a place of opportunity, if it's to continue to deal with difficult problems of people, if it is continue to be the land of a free people, determined to enlarge the possibilities of freedom for every American today and for the indefinite future. Humphrey is the man to do that kind of a job. Thank you, and God bless you all. And by applying it, we've raised our country to a pinnacle of strength for the improvement of the lives of our people that no country has ever seen in the entire history of mankind. So we need to continue to build in this way. We cannot afford the insensitivity, the lack of understanding, the lack of creativity, the neglect and the potential retrenchment of a Nixon administration if we're to continue to build this kind of an America. There's nothing in his record as a congressman or as a vice president to encourage us to believe that he understands the need for this kind of positive, creative, constructive policy in America if we're to build the lives of our people and build the strength and prosperity of our country. We've done this for the last 8 years. Jack Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson promised that we would do this kind of a job. We've kept that promise, and keeping that promise in the future is the way to deal with the difficult and frustrating and complex problems which we face in America today. The way to solve a problem is to meet it. The way to solve a problem is to meet it, not to back away from it. And through the 50s, we had an administration which backed away from the problems of education, of our cities, of environmental pollution. It played it safe with the economy, risked a little unemployment in order to keep our economy healthy. We can't afford that kind of health in the American economy in the years ahead. We need a pulsating, moving, dynamic, viable America, the kind Texans understand, the kind Texans have built here in Texas, to build the kind of future America wants. So with your help, Hubert Humphrey will provide that kind of leadership and help carry America onto ever higher plateaus of achievement for the benefit of all of us. Thank you so much. God bless you. Grievances having to do with having to live in environments that are unacceptable and that lock people into lives with little or no hope. Americans from the beginning have refused to accept those kinds of limitations upon freedom. Americans have recognized from the beginning, and especially those who moved out to the great open spaces in Texas and the rest of the West, that a human being to be free must be free of the limitations of environment and of inadequate economic opportunity, as well as free of political restriction. What has made America great is that in one way or another, Americans made this possible for most Americans. What remains here in the 1960s is to make it possible for those Americans who have not yet made it. That's the job. It's the kind of job we've excelled in doing in America. It's the kind of job we can continue to do. We simply have faith in the heritage, courage, determination, and the potential of the human being. We built this great country not out of bricks and mortar, but out of what is within every free human being who's a citizen of this land. That's what's built America. To improve the lives of people. So let's not fear it. Let's use it in the way that we've always used it. We've been told that this is no longer the answer. We
because that message is being peddled, this campaign, by candidates in this election. We need to meet the threat. And there's only one way that it can be met, and that is the hearts and minds of individual American citizens. Whether we are to achieve the good life for all Americans in the years ahead depends upon those personal choices. And what are those choices? Well, we can choose to hate people of different races, religions, and ethnic backgrounds. By that choice, poison the atmosphere as surely as if we poured untreated fumes into the air. Or we can choose another path, the path of listening to each other, of understanding each other, and of working together for the only kind of America that ever made any sense, one America. We've opened our educational system to all, seeking to ensure that the only test for advancement is ability and the willingness to learn. But let me spell out what remains to be done. An estimated 140,000 able but needy high school graduates, other than to vote against increasing the school lunch program while he was a senator, and to stand against the federal aid for school construction and teacher salaries while he was vice president. That's his record. If you want to see a real credibility gap, read Mr. Nixon's speeches on education and then take a look at his record. What you'll find is a yawning chasm that makes the Grand Canyon look like a Texas irrigation ditch. In 1965, we passed the Elementary and Secondary Education Act over the opposition of 73% of the Republicans in the House of Representatives. But a federal investment that has tripled in the last 5 years to $13 billion a year. The federal government now invests more each year in education than in the whole 180 years before Jack Kennedy. That's the kind of investment that we have believed in making in the minds and the potential of every one of our children, whoever he or she is, whatever their circumstance, wherever they live. Because ability is found everywhere in the great mass of mankind. No race, no people of any national origin escapes God-given blessing of ability, creativity, and even genius. And all of this must be developed wherever it is found. And so this is an obvious investment in terms of the human development, which it makes possible for our country. But looking at the cold, hard dollars, it is an investment also. If a man gets a high school education, his lifetime income is increased by $100,000. If he goes on to get a college education, it goes up another $200,000. The taxes on this additional income will more than repay the initial investment in his education. So when you talk about the investment of $13 billion a year, you're talking about a revolving fund, which is going to return a profit to the taxpayers of our country, as well as a return to the people of our country, in terms of a more enlightened citizen. Now, would we have had this kind of progress the last 8 years if Mr. Nixon had been elected president over Mr. Kennedy? Mr. Nixon described the 8 years from 1952 to 1960 in his campaign speeches of that year as the period of the greatest progress and prosperity in the history of the country. You remember those 8 years. Nothing was done about federal assistance or federal investments in education during that period, notwithstanding the promises of the Great Crusade in 1952. You remember those promises. Not one of them was redeemed, notwithstanding the fact that Democratic Congresses in the last 6 years of that administration did their utmost to get an education bill through the Congress. And when it finally reached a tie vote in the Senate, with the vice president present in the chamber in a position to cast the deciding vote for education, he didn't move and let the bill die with a tie vote. And now, is that the kind of a man you want to preside over the educational policies of this country in the next 4 years? Here's a man who always has had a knack of talking a good game. But when it comes down to action, real concern and determination and a sense of urgency, he has demonstrated those qualities only when he wanted to win an election campaign. You people in Texas are people of action. And you understand that when we need to do a job, there's only one way to do it, and that's to get at it. In the 1960s, Jack Kennedy understood that in order to get this country moving again, it was essential to get at it. And the first job he tackled was to get the economy moving again from a recession in which we found ourselves in 1960, through a period of 91 unbroken months of economic growth and expansion, which have added $364 billion of national production this year over the level that it achieved in 1960. And as a result of this great increase in national production, in national strength, we've been able to double our national investment in education from $26 billion a year, including federal, state, and local contributions, to $52 billion a year in education. As a result of this great growth in national strength, we've been able to double our national investment in health facilities to take care of those not able to provide for themselves. And then here is the real key. In building this great national strength, we've been able to double our national investment in new industries, in new manufacturing plants that generate the economic strength, provide the jobs, provide the opportunities, and enable people to contribute further to the growth of our country. This is what we've done. We've increased our capacity to solve our common problems. We've increased our capacity to provide opportunities. We've increased our capacity to make it possible for individual Americans to grow. And in the process, to build more satisfying lives. to become better neighbors, to become better citizens, to contribute to the building of a more enlightened society. We build our capacity to solve tough problems, including the tough problems we face in the year 1968. This is what Jack Kennedy promised in 1960. This is what Lyndon Johnson promised to continue to do when he took over in 1963. This is what we've done in the last 8 years, and America is the better for it. We must continue to do it. And why? Well, I'd like to close with these words from Jack Kennedy, spoken in that campaign of 1960. He said, "We need a leadership dedicated to our nation's spiritual ideals. Leadership inspiring in its sense of moral values. And leadership passionate in its devotion to the American heritage of liberty. We need a president whose every utterance will lift the hearts of those around the world who thirst for power or plenty, but who thirst even more for a leader of conviction and courage and compassion. We need, finally, the whole nation willing to recapture the spirit of 1787, willing to commit itself once again to great ends, willing to dedicate itself to the enrichment of our society as well as our lives." Jack Kennedy understood that Americans would always respond to challenge for greatness, that Americans would always prefer the appeal to their finer instincts, and that if it were made possible for them to develop themselves, they would respond effectively to the task of building a great country. A country great not only for those who are rich, great not only for those who are affluent, but great also for those who are seeking to escape intolerable conditions, those seeking for hope, for improvement, those seeking for better things. This is when a country is great, when it offers hope for all its people. Of Texas people, I've seen not only warmth and friendship and hospitality, but I've seen what I've always believed to be in every American: the willingness to respond to any call which required decency, compassion, understanding, and courage of the American people. I've seen it in your faces today. And having seen it, you've encouraged me to believe that on November 5th, Hubert Humphrey will be elected President of the United States. Individuals and groups working together can do so freely and flourish. You can't create compassion by legislative action. But the American people, in that great compassion which has been the hallmark of America, can and will and is determined to help those who, whether permanently or temporarily, are unable to get ahead out of their own resources. To help them to help themselves, create for them the kind of opportunity we want for all Americans. There's only one way to do that, to believe in each other, to understand each other, to trust each other, and to build the only kind of America that has ever made any sense, a united America. This is what my father came to this country to find. This is what the first Texans came to the West to find. This is what all Americans have always sought. This is what all Americans are seeking now. Whatever happens in this election, I hope that America on November 5th will forever reject the opposite doctrine of fear and hatred and division preached by a man like George Wallace.
Tennessee, October 30, 1968.
Because of gang violence and juvenile delinquency in slums, which were not replaced by decent housing and effective community development programs. How do you measure the cost to families? Medical care for their aged parents, because an administration refused to support Medicare. Not all of the cost is measured in dollars and cents. Some of it is measured in human suffering, in loss of dignity and hope, in the loss of natural resources and natural beauty. How do you measure the cost of 12 million children who go to bed hungry at night because of the administration's indifference? How do you measure the cost? How do you measure the cost of preventing 35% of our brightest high school students from going on to college in the next Republican year? How do you measure the cost of seeing a family fall apart because of low pay or no pay at all? Pollution of our lakes, our streams, our rivers, and our air? And how do you measure the cost of land erosion, ravaged forests? How can anyone figure out the cost of the Republican platform, which promises everything and says nothing? How can anyone calculate the cost of doing nothing now and paying later? John Kennedy asked that question in 1960, and he answered. And what did his answer produce? It produced 92 months of growing prosperity, an increase in our national production to which I've already referred. And those are big figures. But what do they mean? They mean that there are more jobs.
Amen.
Still not enough. Better paying jobs. All of us are better able to provide for our families, for the education of our children, for our own old age. But what has it meant for us as a society? It has meant that we've been able to double our annual investment in education as a nation from $26 billion to $52 billion a year. It means we've been able to double our annual investment in health facilities to help provide for those who couldn't provide for themselves. It's meant that we've been able to double our annual investment in new industry, new manufacturing plants, to provide the jobs and the opportunities without which we can't expect to make life meaningful for all Americans. The issue of this campaign, really, is the question of what vision of America do we want to implement in the next 4 years? One thing ought to be clear to anyone who understands the American story, and that is that we created this great America of 1968 out of our people. It hasn't been built out of bricks and mortar or machinery. It's been built because in a free society, we've unleashed the potential and the creative energies of the individual human being and developed the skills and the talents and the know-how, and the drive and the organizational ability and the managerial skills necessary to build and operate complex modern industrial society. We've done it out of our people. We understood from the beginning that this is the way that you build a free society in a great country. And our status as a nation in 1968 is proof triumphant that it works. Sure, we've got problems. We've got to end the war. We've got to create harmony among our people. We've got to learn to govern our cities, and we've got to make them livable places of opportunity. Great jobs to do. Really, they're not problems. They're jobs to do. The kind of jobs we've done in America for 180 years. We know that the way that you build a society that can deal with this kind of problem is to build it out of the hearts and minds and bodies of a free people. Oh, I know you can't create individual initiative by passing a law in Washington. But with appropriate legislation, you can create a climate in which individual initiative can exercise itself. You can't create, you shouldn't, private enterprise by passing a law in Washington. But passage of legislation to ensure fair dealing enables private enterprise to flourish out of the creativity of our people. You can't create compassion by passing a law in Washington. But you can establish a rule in which the natural decency of our people, the finer instincts of America, can be brought to bear upon those. It is often said of presidents that average kinds of men, when elected to that great office, grow into it and have a capacity for greatness. Or that average lawyers appointed to the Supreme Court of Ireland have that same capacity. Well, this isn't unique. The individual American citizen, when called upon for greatness, is demonstrating in 180 years that he too can rise to the challenge of greatness, submerge his worst instincts, and rise to the level of the best that is in him. That's the American story. We've seen flourishing and blooming on this great continent over these last 180 years. A great industrial machine, it is true. But that is the picture. That is real America. We've seen flourishing here on this continent the picture of what the human spirit can be when it is unleashed in a free society. And I don't care where that spirit resides, in a white American or a black American or a yellow American or a red American, it resides in every human being if given an opportunity. That's the American story. That's what Jack Kennedy understood in 1960. That's what Nixon didn't understand in 1960. That's why he was defeated. This story is what Hubert Humphrey understands in 1968. Mr. Nixon still doesn't understand. That's why Humphrey is going to be elected. Because the American people, in spite of all their doubts, fears and suspicions, truly want to live in a country where people like each other, where people can be comfortable with each other, where people can trust each other. Now, trust is a peculiar kind of equality. Because it means willingness to take a chance on the other fellow. And at times he's going to betray that trust, because he may be evil, he may be weak, or in lashing out against injustice, he may strike at friends as well as foes. But the only answer still is to continue to hold out trust. Because trust stimulates people in the long run to respond in like kind. And that's the way we're going to be. And that's what we've got in Hubert Humphrey. A man we can trust, a man who trusts you. And I think every election always decided on the question of which candidate can be trusted to do the kind of job that the American people really want done in the next 4 years. In my judgment, there's only one presidential candidate who fits that prescription in 1968, and that's my running mate, with whom I'm proud to be associated, Hubert Humphrey.